Welcome to this episode of What's a Frequency, as we have reached the final week of 2025, which does not seem possible. So with this being the end of the year, I'm bringing back some of the most notable pieces we brought to listeners. Some of those illuminate some of the most important hard news that happened over the year, while others dig into cultural trends and involve visiting many varying places in Siouxland. Many of these were personally fun to produce by going out and talking to people all over the area. Some of the pieces you will hear in this retrospective include a talk with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, hearing about a concert by music icon Bob Dylan, checking in on libraries and museums, and learning about a very distinctive college disinformation and media analysis club, and more. We start by bringing back part of a January 2025 episode of What's a Frequency, which aired in the first week of the new term for President Donald Trump with issues related to immigration. Trump was promising mass deportations of people in the United States without legal status, and it was a big topic over the year. For a discussion on the value of immigration and immigrants, I went to the Mary J. Trelia Community House in Sioux City, which was founded in 1921 to help struggling foreign-born people become U.S. citizens and build better lives in Siouxland. You'll now hear from Executive Director Barb Newhouse plus Andrea Parrott, one of the agency's Department of Justice representatives who works with clients on a range of legal immigration matters. They said people in Siouxland were definitely afraid of possible immigration raids. In an era when immigrants can have a bad rap from some people, what would you two say are the benefits, the good aspects of immigration?
Well, I'll start, but Andrea is much more the what I would call the expert in the area. But from my standpoint, I think what we have to remember is someone who immigrates to this country and who works, they pay taxes. They are a part of making life special. You know, I happened to be yesterday in one of the places I was visiting and having a cup of coffee. And I was sitting there listening to the folks. And there was, at one table, there was a family all speaking Spanish. At another table, there was a family all speaking Vietnamese. And I sat there and I just felt so warm and moved by the richness of what was going on among these two families. And you know what? They may not have understood one another, but what they led with is something I learned from one of our ELL teachers, Barb Spalding, who's a great lady. And I learned, your smile is your first language. And what I saw going back and forth among all the people in that coffee shop were smiles. Mm-hmm. They may have been from different countries, but they were smiling and learning from one another. So I think we have to remember that just because you are not born in the United States doesn't mean that you don't bring wonderful value to the country you live in. You get out of whatever place you live in, you get out of what you put into it. And what I see at Mary J. Trelia Community House is our families, our immigrants who are coming through Mary J. Trelia and working are putting a lot into it, and they are reaping the benefits, but we are reaping the benefits from knowing them.
Okay, Andrea or Anna, either of you.
Yeah, I just want to, everything that Barb said is very important, and as she said, you know, there is a lot of misinformation out that, you know, immigrants are using a lot of our resources and all. They pay taxes, and we even have a lot of immigrants that pay taxes that are not eligible for any of the, you know, benefits later. And they help our community be a thriving community in Siouxland here. We have them involved in so many things, and they, you know, the clients that come here, you can tell they're really interested in getting their kids to school and making sure they do well in school, and they want to learn and develop more and become valuable members of our community.
I'm going to also say that, by the way, if you take a look in a state like Iowa, immigration, the work that was done to get things going in the state of Iowa was started by Governor Ray.
In the 1970s.
In the 1970s, absolutely. And Iowa has done a great job of making sure we've got a lot of tax dollars coming from in the state of Iowa, coming from folks who came through immigrant communities. Our agriculture has gone up as one of the sustainable areas that involves a lot of folks who are immigrants into this country. And it has given us a new way of looking at food supply, the food supply chain, and new foods that we are all starting to take for granted because we're so used to them.
Mm-hmm. They become the norm in some ways. Yeah, right. Another question about kind of the national conversation of immigration. Is there anything that frustrates you on the discussion of immigration as it's sometimes carried out nationally or maybe even locally sometimes?
I'll let Andrea start with that.
I'll start with that. The misinformation that has been distributed and that is believed. Just one quick example. Somebody told me, totally convinced, that everybody who crosses the border gets a credit card from the government with $1,000 on it. That's totally wrong. Absolutely wrong. Also, people just think that, you know, people can come in and then go get benefits, you know, food stamps and whatever. Not true. There are a lot of barriers and a lot of that needs to be done. And so it's very complicated. It's a very long and difficult process. And part of it is that immigration law has not been updated since the 1990s.
I think the other frustrating part, and again, I'll defer to the expert on this, but the other frustrating part, and a lot that I've learned from Andrea over the time that I've been involved with Mary J. Treya Community House, is it's a matter of understanding definitions. Mm. You know, the difference between refugee, asylee, immigrant, etc. Those definitions are very important. And when people mow over those definitions, it's what gets them into trouble and leads to that misinformation.
And maybe I'll just add that, because a lot of people think that people just coming across the border are refugees. And yeah, they might be fleeing danger, they might be fleeing poverty, but they're not refugees under legal terms. So then they think, oh, and refugees get all these benefits. Refugees under legal terms are vetted immensely, very thoroughly for years overseas. Once they are admitted to the United States, they have legal status from day one. And they can work really quickly. They can, you know, earn money and contribute to the economy. And also they have to repay their flights that the government paid for them to bring them here. So that is a big confusion, because, you know, refugees, you just think, well, everybody who comes here is a refugee. No, under legal terms, that's very different.
Thank you.
And I think a key thing that Andrea just said that I think would help people is to understand that when they come here, anything that they're given, it's considered a loan. Mm. And that loan is repaid over time after they get jobs, et cetera. They get set up with repayment plans on those things.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. Next up on this Best of 2025 What's a Frequency show, the Dinosaurs of Hell Creek exhibit had just begun a six-month run at the Sioux City Public Museum in early 2025. That exhibit featured the work of two local dinosaur hunters, Darren Maurer and Brian Buckmeyer. At the Hell Creek Formation in South Dakota, these two Siouxland men have found fossils of a Triceratops, Tyrannosaurus Rex, and even a Dakota Raptor. They talked about the huge turnout that had come in the opening days of the exhibit, plus their initial dinosaur find in South Dakota in the 1990s that might have been better with crying. Tell me when you first started to team up, and do you remember like the first time, like what you got? Could you kind of just describe and then how you kind of grew from there?
Well, we met each other in the mid-90s and began hunting dinosaur bones together shortly after that. And I recall the first trip I went on, didn't know too much, and did find a little piece of exposed bone and started to dig it up, and it was a partial Triceratops femur, and it was about maybe half to two-thirds of the leg bone, which it's a big leg bone, so this thing's about roughly 3 feet long probably, and got it dug up, and we got it secured and plastered, and the vehicle was quite a ways from where we found this bone, and we had to carry this fossil for probably a good mile and a half, and Brian and I took turns carrying it.
So it's heavy. It's not just three, it's heavy as well.
Very heavy. Okay. Very heavy. It was well over 100 pounds, and so we took turns carrying it, and we would set little goals for ourselves. You say, you see that rock up there? We're going to make it to that rock. And we would carry it, and we'd have to set it down and take a rest. I was never so happy to get something back to the vehicle in my life. But that was the first, technically the first dinosaur fossil that I found and dug up was that leg bone. And it was just totally hooked.
I would say, if that, from if that, that doesn't point, hook you,
I mean,
like,
it was,
yeah.
I thought, I couldn't believe it. You know, it was so, such a special event.
Well, in the last quarter mile was uphill too.
When we do talks at schools a lot, and I always tell the kids that story, and I always mention if crying would have helped, I would have been crying, but it wouldn't have helped me. And it's hot, and it's I think dinosaur hunting gets romanticized a little bit too from television, and that it's not really, it's a lot of hard work. It's hot, dusty. You know, there's nowhere to get out of the sun usually, and the wind is blowing, and there's always something. So we've been in the heat, we've been snowed on, rained on, you name it, we've been there.
And I wanted to I think this is a good point to ask this, because I just don't know this. What are the rules or laws? I guess laws maybe governing it. Like, what can a person personally keep versus, like, I don't know. As a kid, I just thought like it had to be turned over to a museum or perhaps to a university. Can you explain that?
We're very conscious of that. We don't want to go on any land that's government-owned or BLM land or anything like that, because you can't remove vertebrate fossils from those areas unless you were a college or somebody that got a permit up front and agreed to place those items into their collections or museums or whatever. We go on private ranch land. The land is deeded to the landowners. We're very careful about that. There are some commercial fossil people out there that go out and collect, and they sign contracts with the landowners and that. We basically have an oral handshake contract that says if we find anything significant, we'll let you know, and then you can decide what you want to do with it, because it's technically the landowner's fossil at that time. And we have done that in the past on things. We found a portion of a T-Rex skull, and we found, Draco Rex was a new dinosaur that was found in 2003. And we talked to the landowners and say, hey, this is what we found. None of them really are that excited about a triceratops bone or a duckbill bone that we find. If we found a whole skeleton, they might be excited about that. So that's kind of the rules. We go to ranches that have the properly deeded property, and it's the owners, the deeded owners' land, and they get the fossils in that land.
So let's get into the specifics of what's in the Dinosaurs of Hell Creek exhibit. What's all in it? What's notable about it?
Well, for years now, we've been doing programs at grade schools, high schools, some colleges, universities, and some museums, where the program we give or the talk we give kind of talks about, you know, where we go and why we go there and how we find the bones and what we do with the bones. So we've done that talk countless times. And the exhibit, we started talking about this exhibit probably about 5 or 6 years ago. We started to conceive this exhibit. And at that time, what we did is we patterned the exhibit off of the talk. So the exhibit is basically the dinosaur talk we've been giving for a long time, put into exhibit form. So when you enter the exhibit, it talks about what the Hell Creek is, where it's located, how it was formed, that type of thing, why there's dinosaur bones there and why they're not in other locations. And then as you progress through the exhibit, it talks about a little bit of the history of the Hell Creek and some of the fossils that have been found there. It goes through the steps of finding and excavating a dinosaur fossil bone. And there's a time-lapse video that runs that's pretty cool. It starts out with a bone partially exposed from the ground, and through the time-lapse shows it getting dug up, cleaned, prepped, and prepared for museum quality to show in a museum.
Okay.
And the fossil's actually sitting right there by the video, and the video is about 15 hours of time condensed to down to about 6 minutes. So it's but that's pretty interesting. And then the last part of the show is roughly, I think Matt down at the museum said it's about 2,000 square feet of dinosaur fossil exhibits where you can actually look at the bones.
Music icon Bob Dylan played a concert in Sioux City on April 2nd as he expanded the tour that he was carrying out in the upper Midwest. Dylan had been much discussed at that time after the December 2024 release of his biopic film, A Complete Unknown, which chronicles his music career launch from 1961 onward. So for What's the Frequency, we delved into the career of Bob Dylan. The guests included Dave Bernstein, a concert promoter who was president of the Orpheum Theater Board of Directors. Bernstein shared a few tales of prior times Dylan had played in Sioux City, including what happened when meeting the musician after the show with a friend who knew him from the 1950s summer camp.
You know, I we've been talking with Don, who's bringing the show back again, for, you know, bugging him to try and get Dylan back for years. And so we're really excited. It sold out very quickly. And, you know, I think someone like Dylan, especially, you know, post Nobel Prize and movie and everything else, I mean, I think people truly realize the guy is a, you know, an American treasure. So I'm excited to see him and looking forward to it. You know, it'll be great. It'll be great. We thought we had it confirmed like a year ago, and then he scuttled the whole leg of that tour. And I think, you know, doing the show right on the heels of the movie definitely helped. I mean, it sold out very quickly. I think it was done in like 15 minutes, which is pretty great for us. So.
And I think I saw on social media you saw A Complete Unknown and you liked the film. Is that correct, Dave?
Yeah, I love the film. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it did a great job of telling a story of, you know, a part of Dylan's history, and I thought that was cool. So yeah, really, really good. Really good.
Thank you. And the voice you just heard there, he's Dave Bernstein, as this What's the Frequency episode is about Bob Dylan in advance of his concert here at the Sioux City, in Sioux City at the Orpheum Theater, which will be on Wednesday, April 2nd. And what you said about the movie there made me think of this. Rolling Stone magazine in 2020 named the Dylan song, Like a Rolling Stone, the greatest song of all time. It was their recap of the 500 greatest songs of all time. They cited how Dylan bent folk music to his own will, thereby, quote, transforming popular song with a content and ambition with Like a Rolling Stone, unquote. Any thoughts on Dylan and his legacy from like that song and his, I guess, all of his complete discography?
I just think it's, you know, a roadmap of, you know, at least a perspective of the story of America, you know, North America. The U.S. And I think that a lot of people who follow and like Dylan like different, you know, parts of his history and career and music. And I think there's just so much there that it's super telling. And I know Dylan live, not unlike other greats like, you know, Van Morrison or folks like that, you're going to get what Dylan decides to play. And that's great, because I think his body of work is amazing. I think that's why he got the Nobel Prize.
Thank you. And I know back to the, going back to his first show at the auditorium in Sioux City, which I think was in the 90s. Is that correct?
Seemingly, yes.
Okay. We'll go with that. You had an encounter with him. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was kind of tangential, but we'd gone to the show and I don't overly remember the show at that time. But my dad had gone to summer camp with Dylan for a year. I think they were in the same cabin along with a guy named Bill Hurwitz, who used to own the Boulevard store. And Bill had a picture of them from camp. And so I kind of knew how to get backstage at the auditorium. And I took my dad and Bill were pretty tenacious, and I took them back there and we're kind of standing around. Dylan doesn't really do meet and greets. And all of a sudden Dylan, you know, comes out on his way out the door, and Bill kind of jumps out in front of him and says, "Bob, it's Bill Hurwitz." And Bob kind of looks at him and gives him a hug, obviously remembered him. and Bill pulls out this FedEx envelope with this picture and shows him this picture from summer camp as a kid. And Dylan looks at the picture and says, I don't have this one, you know, and he slides it back in the FedEx envelope, shoves it in his coat, heads out the door and leaves. And that was Bill's only copy of the picture. So unfortunately, Dylan's got the picture now. But that was the encounter. And it was nice. It seemed kind of warm for, you know, someone that maybe didn't have normally those kind of encounters. So I thought that was cool. And it did validate the fact that my dad had been telling me for years that he was in a cabin with Bob Dylan at summer camp. So, that was,
proof. Proof. Dylan himself.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Billy claimed that Dylan owed him $20 still, and he borrowed $20, he drove through Sioux City or something, stopped and bummed $20 off. I don't know if that's true.
Next here on our 2025 retrospective best of episode of What's a Frequency, many huge hands-off rallies took place across the nation on Saturday, April 5th. In downtown Sioux City, about 300 people chanted and carried signs that were critical of actions taken by President Donald Trump over recent weeks. Some of the signs and speakers referenced cuts made by the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, to federal programs. This piece presents some of the chants that sprang up, plus rally participant Ronnie Capron, a former Sioux City councilwoman and business owner, discussing why she came to the hands-off event.
Hello, I'm Rhonda Capron. I'm from Sioux City. I have big concerns about not just the last 3 months, but about our whole history of what's going on. I'm here for democracy and the Constitution and our rights and just smart thinking. We have missed out on common sense here, I believe. And, you know, we need to get people involved and we need to get people, you know, engaged in what's going on in this country. So I'm not happy with what's going on, and it scares me. So I came here today just to show my support, show that I believe in democracy, that I believe in our people, I believe in our Constitution, and I believe that we need to fight, and we've got to do it in numbers. We can't do it one or two people at a time. It takes the country to show up, and if we don't show up, they've already showed up. Sure, I tell you, there's a lot of things that give me hope. You know, I think we have good people here in our America, in our nation, and we just need to understand what is that at cost. And we're going to be losing a lot if we don't stand up and really say what we believe. And if we don't do that, we're all going to be in a dictatorship. We're going to be looking for a place to live, maybe looking for work, looking for food. Trump has destroyed this country, and he's done it in a minimal amount of time. And we got to take that time back, and we got to move on. I'm telling you, I'm impressed. And we settled down at the Fed building, and they told us that we could not be on their property, so we moved up to the museum. And the crowd keeps getting bigger, and I'll tell you what, people are out there standing up for what they believe, and that's what we need to see. And you never know until you do it, and we need more of this. We need more people standing up for us, for ourselves. That's how we're going to win, and we have to win.
Next up on this What's a Frequency 2025 retrospective, we're bringing back a May chat with Art Cullung, a lifelong newspaperman who has reported for more than 30 years in Storm Lake in Buena Vista County. Art is editor and co-owner with his brother John Cullen of the Storm Lake Times-Pilot, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for a series of editorials about agricultural surface water pollution in Iowa. When Cullen referenced the title of his new book, he told me, quote, "It may be perceived as vulgar, but we live in vulgar times," end quote.
Well, thanks for having me, Brett. I appreciate it.
Yep, good to talk to you again. The book release comes on September 28th, is what I've heard. It'll be part of the Okoboji Writing Retreat. Let's start with the title of the book, which is, it's as eye-opening as it gets. Tell us the title of the book.
Dear Marty, we crapped in our nest. Notes from the edge of nowhere.
Okay, now explain.
That's the title.
Yeah.
And it may be perceived as vulgar, but I think we live in vulgar times.
And who is Marty?
Yeah, Marty is my old best bud from high school, Marty Case. We talk on the phone frequently. He lives in Minneapolis now, and he's a writer and a historian, especially on Native American affairs. And lived in Sioux City for a while when he was younger, and then moved to Storm Lake in high school. And so it's cast as sort of a letter to Marty about what's happened to Storm Lake in Northwest Iowa over the past 50 years since he left.
Okay. And we'll get into a little more details here in just a second. But one more question before we get there. Like, what was the genesis for writing this book? Like, what drove you to think this was something that you needed to publish?
This friend of mine, Steve Semkin, is the publisher of Ice Cube Press in Iowa City. And he had been he'd been asking me to write a book for some time. And I was putting him off because I didn't really think I had a book. And what I did is Marty Case and I actually wrote one chapter together called The Corn Gospel. And then I wrote some other pieces for it and then merged in stuff I'd already written for the Storm Lake Times pilot to kind of come up with a mosaic of what consolidation has done to rural Iowa and what climate change is about to do.
What are the examples of so-called crapping the nest?
Well, the fact that we have the Mississippi River is in crisis. According to American Rivers, it's the most endangered river in America. And a couple three years ago, the Raccoon River also made the list of most endangered rivers in America. Our surface waters are toxic drains, and our lakes are full of fecal coliform bacteria, and there's beach advisories. We are literally crapping in our nest, and we have more livestock than we can handle, and livestock are the mortgage lifters, but we don't own the livestock anymore, and we're being inundated with manure. And this is not the same economy that existed in 1975 when Marty Case and I graduated from St. Mary's High School in Storm Lake, where it was all Union Brothers at the high-grade meat packing plant or the Wilson plant in Cherokee, and all paying union wages and 160-acre farms where farmers raised hogs and owned those hogs and took them to into an independent open market where you could discover price. That's all gone. It's history. And the argument of the book is that we're the poorer for it. But I think nature's going to demand that we correct course.
Thank you. This What's the Frequency show on the most notable shows of 2025 now shifts to June, when I spend an hour in downtown Sioux City to shed light on the Hill House Art Collective that opened a few weeks before. It was a great opportunity to hear people describe their art and the hopes for what this distinctive 1880s era building can be for the local arts community. I spoke with artists Tracy Tuttle, Jonas Lynch, and Jess Hammond, who raved about the potential for what may happen in the months ahead in the Hill House Art Collective at 815 Nebraska Street. You'll hear one of the organizers, Ben Kneffler, talk about how this whole endeavor kicked off. This is a really distinctive historic building in Sioux City.
Built in 1882 by the Gilman family. If people will recognize Gilman Terrace from Sioux City, named after the Gilman family. First native-born Sioux Cityan to be mayor of Sioux City. So 1882, the home was built. They lived in the house for a while. It was it shared time as a nursing home. It was a funeral home. And then since the middle 70s, Bass Advertising, the Bass family, had this house, and really they're the reason that we're able to do what we're doing here today.
Okay. And so was it something, why this house? Why is this the right house for what you're envisioning for the Hill House Arts Collective to be?
It's the right house because of the math. We're able to have a big space in a way that is affordable for people to utilize it. And it just happens to be just a dynamite spot, just a really cool old house. 815 Nebraska is the address, but yeah, if you think about the big Shrine Temple right across the street.
I came to the open house and was just blown away by some of the stuff that you just mentioned here, but just describe kind of the distinctiveness of what is, you know, the walls, et cetera, that all the I guess the crafting that made this house, that's part of this house.
Yeah, we did a dive into some of the history. Sioux City legend Jim Jung has helped us with some of the history stuff. But essentially, it is just full of just beautiful, beautiful handmade woodwork, bird's eye maple, lots of build-ins. It's just like if you could envision just a big, huge, beautiful home just stacked full of amazing woodwork. That's us. You're here.
Okay. And at three stories, is that right?
Three stories and a basement. Yeah, you got it.
Okay. How long have you had this, and when did this endeavor launch, so to speak?
Myself and Dolph Ivner were driving up the street, and there was a for sale sign on it, and that was May 1st. We bought the place kind of on a whim with an idea. And we had our open house on the 31st. So relatively new endeavor, but just tons of work that's gone in by the folks that are already utilizing the space, and myself and Dolph. And we were able to throw it together pretty quickly, mainly because the house was in such great shape. But we intend this to be a group conscience. We want it to be, first and foremost, self-sustaining. So it's very important that this place is able to go without grants, without funding, without, you know, going out and asking for money. That's where the math worked for this space. It just takes a little bit of rent from folks, and this place is good to go. So Dolph and I got it going, but moving forward, it's going to be group conscience. The folks that inhabit the house, use it for their workspace. They'll really be, you know, it's kind of up to them to keep it going and to take it in the direction that they see fit.
So what arts are we talking about? Visual arts? Is music? Like, give me kind of the range for who is currently working in here.
It's a mix. We've got a studio upstairs. We have bands in there that are recording music and that work out of that space. Obviously a lot of visual stuff. We have a gal that just came in that's doing a lot of digital stuff. We have somebody upstairs running a desk. And they work on basically taking people through processes, like how does an organization or how does a human being figure out what direction they want to go in, that kind of thing. So it's a loose word, art, and this house is the same. If it's art, it's art. We'll do it here.
Okay. And will people like they a little bit of rent that they provide, or how does this work?
Yeah, really easy system. It's $1.50 a square foot. So we want it to be fair. We want it to be, you know, everybody kind of knows what they're getting into. We're month to month. There's no long-term contracts, anything like that. We want it to work for people. And if it doesn't, no hard feelings. We want to stick anybody in any sort of contracts or anything like that. But really, just like I said before, we just kind of want to let the house do its thing. And from the people that have come in so far, it's doing that. It's really turning into a really neat space. It's meant to be, you know, affordable. People are sharing studios, you know, pitching in together, doing that kind of thing. So that's been cool too. But yeah, just get people through here, get bodies in this place, and get stuff rolling in and rolling out.
Take me back to the, I think it was either May 31st, whatever that Saturday was, about four Saturdays ago. Mm-hmm. What was the reception that night, and what were some takeaways from how that evening went?
I was blown away. We didn't do any, we're attraction rather than promotion. So we're going to be here. We're going to be doing our thing. If people are into it, we want them to come check it out, but really kind of attraction rather than promotion. We didn't do any sort of social media, anything around this. We printed out a bunch of invitations and we started handing them out all over town. And we had a massive turnout. It was a blast. We're going to do more of it. It really reinforced, that idea and that thing that people want to do, which I was hoping would happen. It did. But yeah, we had a couple hundred people through here. Maybe, I don't know. You were here. You tell me.
It yeah. Felt like a lot. I would say definitely a couple hundred people for sure.
Yeah. It was a good time. So we're going to do more of that. You know, do that a couple times a year and try to have fun with the community. You know, that's kind of what it's about.
Also in June, I had another venture to walk and talk with people who have been flocking to the Missouri Riverfront area of Sioux City for a $12 million project designed to broaden quality of life pieces. I'm Brett Harrith, and welcome to What's a Frequency, our weekly show on Siouxland Public Media. I'm down for a special show taping at the Sioux City Riverfront. There's a whole host of huge amount of improvements that have been made along the riverfront to improve quality of life, to give all kinds of recreational structures over several hundred yards of this stretch of the Missouri River here in Sioux City. It's the $12 million Chris Larson Park Riverfront Development Project. It was completed in 2024, and I've been meaning to get down here since last fall for this episode, so I'm very excited to talk to people here today. I'm basically going to walk and talk and interview people and talk to people about why they're here, what they like about all these amenities. But we are located at the former site of the Argosy Casino along the Missouri River. It's a project that includes park spaces for small and large family gatherings, event spaces, native plantings, there's active recreation areas, fitness stations, there's three park shelters, there's restroom facilities, there's two basketball courts, there's a dog park, yes, for both small and large dogs. And there's equipment for children ages 2 to 12, and there's all kinds of enhancements to the recreational trail system. I personally come down here a couple times per week, and I bike along the trail, and most evenings when I come in around 6:30 p.m., this place is packed in warm weather. I'm here on a early June day. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's definitely filling up here in the late afternoon. Again, the city leaders... This was a $12 million project. It was designed to be a transformational project to activate the area, and it's accessible from Interstate 29 and also from downtown Sioux City right off Virginia Street. So what you heard at the beginning there is, and maybe you can hear in the back, is the splash pad, which is here at the Chris Larson Park Riverfront Redevelopment. And first I'm going to come over here and talk. Hello, I'm Brett. Hi, thank you. Thank you. And I wanted to get started. So first of all, what's your name, and do you live in Sioux City or a different town?
No, I live in here in Sioux City. Okay. On the west side.
And your name, please?
Brittany Sansasi.
Okay. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
Hi, Brittany. Thank you for being here. Thank you for talking to me, I guess. How often do you come down here, and what, who's all with you today? Like, what family members or friends or whoever is with you?
I have my five kids, my three boys and my two girls, and then this is my mother. Last year we came down here pretty much almost every day after my kids got out of school. So, you know, it was pretty fun. They like it. If not, we'll go to other ones as well. But they like this one. Yeah.
Have you been around Sioux City enough to remember when this, before this was built here, and what like basically what was down here along the riverfront?
Yeah, there was really nothing here when I moved here, maybe I want to say roughly about 5 to 6 years ago. And before then, it was, you know, there wasn't nothing. You know, I like how they have the basketball court. They have all, you know, this right here for the kids, and then they have the new park, and then they're also working on, you know, the other park down there. It's, I think it's good for the kids.
Thank you, Brittany. And I just learned, I'm just going to read something here. I have a sheet of paper, as you can see. I this is from the city's website, and I follow this, the topic of this being built for, you know, this took a lot of years for this to come together. It was a $12 million project altogether. I did not know until I looked at a graphic on the city website that it's designed to be community spaces to the north, as we look here, I guess, to our right. Mm-hmm. In the middle, kind of where we are, is everyday spaces. And then if you go a little farther down to the south, it's called Embrace the River. And that's where they have some commemorations of kind of historical things in Sioux City, including like the Lewis and Clark expedition that comes through here. So what would you say with your family, Brittany, that you guys would use the most?
I remember when they used to have the boat. Where was it? Right down here, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a plaque real close to us here that explains when the riverboat was here.
Yeah, I remember that. And then who was it? You used to work there?
The riverboat?
No. Or well, her and my stepdad, who passed away, you know, quite a few years ago. They used to go there, and yeah, like we used to live here, you know, quite a few times, but we've always moved around, so it's just like it always improves. So.
And again, that is, it's not just the city council, you know, who are the elected people to, you know, basically spend our money, but they also, there's fundraising that was done for this, and there was some grants and such, but it all was to basically get people down here using this place. And it sounds like your family, you said you've been coming since last year.
Yeah, pretty much. We usually, before they opened this for, you know, the summer, we was always over here at the park, or we'd go, you know, walk the trail, or me and my brother would go over there to, you know, play basketball, or the kids would play with the little sound thing that they have over there. So yeah, we've been down here quite a few times.
Sounds like you use a lot of this.
Yeah, yeah, especially with 5 kids. And then I get my nieces during the summer as well. They just went home. They're excited to come back so we can come down here. We always try to come down here as much as we can.
And I'm a person that usually comes, I'm coming through here about 6:30 to 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. What different times do you come, and have you noticed, like, is there a busiest time, so to speak?
Yeah, I would say during, like, you know, roughly around the evening times. But since school's out now, or well, it's about to be out tomorrow for Sioux City, I would say probably around noon to evening hours, maybe even later than that, there'll be a lot of people out.
I think I just learned something about the splash pad. I thought this water just turned on every so often, but it looks like we can push a button to make sure to start it.
Yeah, there's that button right there. It comes on and then it goes off. And then at night, during the evening times, they have lights that come on as well. So, and I think you can actually see them right there.
Thank you for mentioning that, Brittany. And last question before I let you go, and I really appreciate the time here today for my What's a Frequency show here on Siouxland Public Media. Do you talk with friends, and do you think it's getting more well-known? Like, is this something like you talk about, like, just, you know, like with a friend or a relative or whatever, like just in a conversation, hey, are you aware of that? Or, you know, like, are people becoming more aware of it through conversations like that?
Yeah, I've actually mentioned it to a few friends, you know, for us to bring our kids down and, you know, us hang out while the kids play and stuff like that. I have, like, maybe roughly a handful of friends that I've talked about it with, you know, actually meeting up this summer to hang out.
Okay. Thank you, Brittany. This has been, I really appreciate the time here. So thank you very much.
Yep.
Now moving further into the 2025 year for this retrospective on the What's a Frequency show on Siouxland Public Media, hosted by me, Brett Hayworth, I did another really fun and informative walk and talk session by journeying to Vermilion, South Dakota, where I checked out a distinctive national museum on the campus of the University of South Dakota. The National Music Museum has been located at USD since 1973. The renowned collections feature fine and historic instruments from many cultures and historical periods. Some of the notable museum pieces include the oldest cello in the world and the oldest playable harpsichord, plus some that are more than 1,000 years old. There is a violin of a soldier who fought in the Civil War, plus a guitar played by Bob Dylan. The voices you will hear now explaining what is in the museum are Arian Sheets, Director of Stringed Instruments, and Anna Van Clay, a museum education employee. What would be some of the older, like what is the oldest items that you have here, and when do they date to?
Yeah, so this drum is a really modern example. This one's from 2011. But in our collection, we have the Amati King cello, which is the oldest surviving cello in the world. And it comes from the mid-1500s from Italy. We have the oldest playable harpsichord in the world, which also comes from Italy. But in terms of the oldest instrument in the collection at all, there's like a side-blown trumpet that comes from South America. That's from like 500 to 700. So we're looking at an instrument that's like 1500 years old. That one's just not on display because we don't have as much of a story about it. And it's also not a terribly visually interesting instrument either. That would probably be our oldest, as far as I know.
And you bring you raise another point that I want to ask about as well is the museum is not static. You're constantly new things are coming. Do people like for some of those examples that you just gave, or for anything that comes here, I guess. Do people know about, like they hear about the National Music Museum and say, oh, maybe that should go there, or do you seek things out? You hear about like maybe a combo.
I would say that it's a combination. We are constantly trying to promote ourselves both to visitors, like we do with My Discovery Saturday programming, where we highlight a lot of different parts of our collection in new ways. So that's one way that we draw people in. A lot of people who come and visit will be like, I have my grandfather's violin, would you guys be interested? And so there is a collections process where they determine historical significance, the provenance, and whether that instrument has a place in our collection.
So sometimes it might be a yes and sometimes it might be a no.
Right, we can't collect everything. It's all about being responsible because we try to collect all of our instruments with perpetuity in mind, right? And so if we just took everything that people gave us, we would not be able to take care of hardly anything we have because we get so many offers. So we don't take everything people offer us, and we do purchase some instruments. And in terms of like donating instruments, we actually recently found out that some AI models, like Google Gemini, if you ask it, where's the best place to donate musical instruments, we come up as the best place.
All right.
So there are a lot of different places that I guess people encounter us, so much so that AI has gotten a hold of us too. But it kind of depends. And you know, sometimes we recently got a hold of a collection of really fine cellos from a man named Ken Cancelosi, which established a playable cello and other string collection at the museum. And that came from a cold call where he just kind of called us and was like, I'm interested in donating these cellos. And then we find out that it's actually an extremely fine collection of historically significant cellos that he wants our students to be able to play. So that's an opportunity for USD students to be able to play on cellos, some of them from like the 18th century, which is a really unique opportunity for students. So it really kind of depends on the instrument.
And then Arian Sheets, I want to get to you. Something Anna said made me want to ask this as well. But so you were here during the renovation. Can you just explain what was the need for the renovation and just how did it go, so to speak?
Well, it was a really stressful process, but one that we had anticipated and were excited for ever since I started working here. Our building, most of the exhibits were already, 20 to 30 years old. There was one that was a little bit newer, 15 years old. But, the museum was a kind of a product of the 80s as far as exhibit design, and there were much more accessible and dynamic ways that objects can be presented to the public. It was also very much let the instruments speak for themselves, kind of art museum type exhibiting. But for something like instruments, that isn't necessarily, it was more like you walk in a room and you're overwhelmed if you don't have any context. And then of course there were aspects like, we needed more space, we needed better climate control. And so the museum built a purpose-built storage facility off campus. And so basically all the collection had to be moved off campus until this building was ready. And then at the same time, we were working on the redesign process with a exhibit design firm in Chicago, Lucy Creative. And then we got the funding to open the ground floor permanent exhibits. That's the other aspect of museum design, is it's often quite expensive. It involves very high quality materials that are designed to age well. A lot of graphics have to be sourced, music permissions, things like that. So it was a huge process to both devise the creative aspects and then also do the installation. And so we were able to open in 2023 with the ground floor exhibits. We have a second phase planned, which is our upstairs exhibits. We are still fundraising for that, but we have all the design elements ready to go. And so we're just waiting on a few more major gifts and any help anyone can provide to move us toward toward getting the second floor installed. But as I mentioned, you know, the materials are quite expensive to do high quality exhibits, and our instruments and our visitors deserve really world-class exhibits to do credit to what we have here at the museum.
Thank you, Erin Sheets.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Late in the year, I went to see the meeting of a club created by students to break down misinformation in mass media via the Disinformation and Media Analysis Club at Western Iowa Tech Community College in Sioux City. According to club information, quote, "We want to bridge the gap between the two primary political parties by creating a space where people can prioritize fact and research over bias and information and can meet and discuss issues. We want people to walk in and be ready to have their beliefs deconstructed," end quote. The club members said politics seemed to be a topic that is rife with disinformation. They shared some tips so people can think critically about the information they share, since social media can have lots of disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation. You'll hear now from that club meeting from Disinformation and Media Analysis Club President Asha Luge and also one of the club sponsors, Steve Warnstadt.
Earlier in the meeting today, I saw a document that had some topics that could be addressed by the club, and I think one was the environment. What are some of the others?
Yeah, so we just kind of sat down probably like a week ago and discussed some topics that all of us individually are interested in. So I know someone had said climate change. I had said like private firefighting. We talked about like the disinformation surrounding Christmas as well. So what we're doing is kind of making a separate tab for each of those. And then the goal is to go in and just identify where disinformation can be spread within those topics. I think last semester we had focused more on, you know, what's the right information, what's the wrong issue. I think now what we're kind of trying to take a step back from that and just have people identify tactics. So the tactics of disinformation within these topics. So we're not going to necessarily, people don't have to worry about coming in and us just discussing politics and arguing politics back and forth, because there is like a true, this is a disinformation tactic, or it's not. So that's more what we're trying to get to discussing.
And then next, Asha Lucian and Steve Warnstadt. Can you give examples of how statistics can be used in disinformation? Some people might give more weight to something, a fact or, you know, a statement if there's a stat that's involved.
Well, I took a stats class last semester, so I should be a little better at this, but I'm not going to word this so correctly, but I know that there's ways that you could use statistics like per a sample size population or for like a whole population, or you can do statistics based on per capita, or so there's different kind of frames of reference within statistics. So you also have to acknowledge what frame of reference that you're looking at these statistics through. You can't just take it for surface value, because most of the time you could have 10 different numbers if you're taking one statistic at surface value.
Well, I was just going to say, when you're involved with public policy, you know, one of the phrases that gets used is you can torture numbers to say anything, right? And you have dealt with political spin, you know, and there's motivations to be selective about the numbers that you use. That's not necessarily disinformation, but it is designed to skew the perspective of people from one perspective. And so what we're trying to do is to at least analyze, okay, so where is that true and how is the information that is being conveyed? Is it conveying the full truth? Are there different ways of taking a look at the same set of numbers to that might tell a different story. It's not designed to necessarily go out and disprove everything.
I know in the club you like to address critical thinking. So if critical thinking is crucial to having a good discourse, I guess, by Americans, what are some key components of critical thinking? And then on the flip side, what are some things that people don't do that has them not thinking critically?
I would say just from my personal experiences, like friends and family, I think that the examples of lacking the critical thinking would be watching one news source and taking all of your information, all of your opinions from that one news source. And there's, I can't remember the bias that goes with that, but basically anything that you look up is going to confirm your information. You're not going to look at the other side of things. So I think the critical thinking part applies when, so if I were going to look at a topic, I would take five different articles from five different news sources across the political spectrum and then try to narrow down what they're saying in common, what's very different, and kind of draw my own conclusions from there based on all of that information. I think that is more the critical thinking that we're trying to get people to do, because it's not so easy, it's not fast, and it's not simple.
And Asha, do you have thoughts on a topic, like a national topic, an international topic, that it might be so fraught with difficulty that it would be hard to discuss here in the Disinformation and Media Analysis Club?
It's my personal opinion that there is nothing off limits. I think that if we have a framework and we know what to look for and how to look for it, as long as we're not getting our emotions or our personal opinions and biases involved, we should, with our framework, be able to approach every single topic. There shouldn't be anything that we can't.
I think one thing that's been really interesting is Aurora, the vice president, is my cousin. So her and I we're like best friends too. So we're together all the time. But it's funny too, because we never thought we would disagree. And now we find in this room more ways that we disagree once we get way deeper into the topics. But it's never we're angry at each other. It's more of a kind of looking at each other like, huh. Yeah. I mean, I think of like kind of morality as a rabbit hole. So the further you go down, the more branches you're going to have off of it. And eventually one of those branches you're going to separate from, no matter who you're talking to. So.
And one of the things that we're trying to achieve with this is respectful dialogue, you know, be listening and engaged and understanding that we're not going to agree on everything, and that to appreciate some of those. And so long as everyone is engaged respectfully in this dialogue, it's good, because we'll all learn something. This is an educational institution. We want to facilitate people thinking and identifying different ways of approaching problems.
More, I just want people to know that they should ask more questions, because I think a lot of this stemmed from me asking questions and figuring out what the right questions to ask were. I think that there's not really many problems that anybody can't solve as long as they ask the right questions. So that's mainly my takeaway.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of What's a Frequency. I really enjoyed thinking about the best of more than 45 shows for the 2025 year and putting this together. I'm also enthused for 2026, when I'll move into a third year for this show. I typically have shows planned out for a few months, but I'm always open to tips for show topics. Thanks for being a part of our station as we work every day to tell the stories about Siouxland that inform, entertain, and expand the mind. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week. What's a Frequency airs on Fridays at 10 a.m. and again on Sundays at 2 p.m. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Brett Hayworth. Enjoy your holidays.